Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. This is the third podcast we're doing on the impact of the Russia-Ukraine war on energy markets. The first two have focused largely on gas markets, so we thought this time we'd have a more detailed look at oil markets. And I'm delighted to have with me Bassam Fatou, who's the director of the Institute. And he has just published an oil market monthly in which he discusses the potential outcomes of Russian oil embargo or indeed just declining Russian oil exports on energy markets. Before we start, though, let me just highlight that this podcast is being recorded on Thursday, the 19th of April. And so all references to prices and other facts are obviously relevant from that date on. So Bassam, in the monthly, you discuss potential losses of Russian oil exports. But as I understand it, losses are already occurring through self-sanctioning by some buyers. So you paint some scenarios in the monthly that reflect this. But can you just talk us through what's happening right now and what might happen in the future?
Thanks, Jim, for having me. I think one of the most complex features of this shock is really trying to find out how big the Russian supply disruption has been so far. Just to recap on what has been happening with the sanctions on Russia, the US, EU, and its allies have imposed very severe sanctions on Russia. But those countries so far have avoided imposing sanctions on oil and gas flows and energy-related payments. There have been some exceptions like the US and the UK. These countries have announced a ban on the importation of Russian crude and oil products. In the case of the UK, imports will be phased out by the end of this year. But the EU and other Asian countries did not take similar steps yet. And there are no official restrictions in these countries to continue to import Russian oil. But what is quite interesting, Jim, in this shock is the extent of self-sanctionings, as you mentioned. Many Western companies have announced that they have suspended oil purchases from Russia. And the impact of this is already seen, where Russian crude and product export to Europe have taken a hit in the month of March and in April so far. But the oil market is a global mature market, and given that oil is liquid and can be stored and moved around at a relatively low cost, we are currently seeing a large diversion of crude oil trade flows. The flows of Russian crude towards Asia, particularly towards India, has risen. In effect, part of Russian crude has shifted from short haul to long haul. And this is clearly evident in the data where Urals crude on water have risen sharply in recent weeks. We may also see a change in trade practices. For instance, blending Russian crudes with non-Russian crudes and ship-to-ship transfers. What is facilitating this redirection in trade flows are the large discounts that Russia is offering on its crude, more than $30 per barrel to the benchmark, according to price reporting agencies. How much of Russian barrels are clearing this way? It's difficult to tell, but the price indicators are telling us that at least some of these barrels are clearing. For instance, at the beginning of the war, premium for Gulf crudes rose sharply as demand for these crudes increased. But as some Asian refiners started getting access to Russian crudes, some of this premium fell from elevated levels. Also, in Europe at the start of the war, as European refiners started replacing Russian Urals with North Sea grades, some of these grades, such as Forties, started trading at a large premium. These have also fallen in recent days. These are indications that Russian barrels are clearing, but not completely. And it's becoming increasingly more difficult to clear Russian barrels as time goes by.
So from what you're saying, it sounds like the disruption is not as great as some people have thought. I mean, has there been any disruption in Russian oil supplies?
Most indications suggest that Russian supplies are being impacted, especially in the month of April. But the actual size of the disruption is really highly unclear at the moment. And ultimately, this would depend on a number of factors. For instance, it would depend on the ability to redirect high volumes of Russian crudes away from Europe. But this could be constrained by multiple factors. There is reluctance of many banks to finance Russian-related commodity transactions. Also, the cost of moving Russian crude in face of heightened security concerns has risen. Higher fuel costs and higher insurance premiums are increasing the cost of diverting Russian barrels away from Europe. These factors complicate the logistics of moving crude around, and there is evidence that disruptions have been taking place recently, as logistical constraints become more binding. And this is working through various ways. Domestic demand in Russia has fallen as the economy contracted. Also, export refineries in Russia have been finding it more difficult to market their products. And as a result, Russian refineries have been cutting their runs, and their demand for crude has declined. Now, in principle, Russian oil companies can start storing that crude oil until demand picks up, but there are storage constraints. The availability of storage in the pipeline network system is very limited, and Russia does not have large storage capacity to start with. The only choice in this case is to cut output at the wellhead. In our reference case, we are assuming that the disruption is about 1 million barrels per day for the month of April and May. But the situation is fluid, and we could see bigger disruptions if the constraints of moving Russian crude or storage constraints become more binding. But also, one cannot exclude the possibility of this disruption getting bigger as a result of the EU deciding to impose sanctions on Russian oil and gas trade flows and energy payments. You know, this still could happen. Or if Russia decides to cut oil supplies to Europe. Also, Jim, significant volumes of Russian barrels are sold on term basis. Basically, this means that companies will buy Russian crude from Russian companies and turn around and sell it in the spot market. Western oil companies and trading houses have pledged not to renew term deals. And some of these deals will end in the next couple of months, and some are ending in 2022. So this raises a question of whether Russian oil firms could really market their crude oil directly to customers. So just in short, as the conflict continues, the risk of bigger disruption increases. And the market is reflecting this in the current oil price, as many are of the view that it's a matter of time before the EU imposes a ban on the purchase of Russian crude and products. That's why we also consider an alternative scenario to our reference case. We refer to this scenario in the report as the curtailment scenario. This scenario of curtailment could actually become our reference in a few months' time. I don't think we have seen really the worst yet when it comes to oil markets.
So in terms of numbers, how much oil could actually be lost if Western countries do fully embargo Russian exports?
In the curtailment scenario, we are assuming a loss of 4 million barrels per day of Russian supplies. To put this in context, in 2021, Russia's production of crude and condensates averaged around 10.5 million barrels per day. And in 2021, Russian crude and product exports averaged almost 7 million barrels per day. The reason why we don't assume a bigger supply loss is that we assume Russia will continue to be able to divert crude away from Europe and the US to other parts of the world, especially if offers of discount and better financing terms continue. Also, not all Russian exports are waterborne crude, and Russian oil exports are transported via pipeline both to Europe and Asia. And we believe the bulk of these will continue, especially the pipeline flows to Asia. Jim, you know, a loss of 4 million barrels per day would be a massive disruption, especially in the current market context. Even before Russia's invasion of Ukraine, oil prices have been rising steadily, reflecting tighter oil market fundamentals. The recovery in oil demand from pandemic continued to surprise on the upside. The sharp rise in natural gas prices, which we saw in the fourth quarter of last year, resulted in some substitution from gas into oil, which gave additional boost to oil demand. Also, OPEC Plus has been returning fewer barrels than planned in the current agreement. And as a result of this, the OECD crude and product stocks continue to fall to multi-year low levels. It's quite important also to remember that the size of the available spare capacity continue to decline. The erosion of these buffers are happening at a time of a very difficult geopolitical environment and increased probability of output disruptions. And by the way, this is not only from Russia, but also from other parts of the world. Just recently, Libya is experiencing a massive loss in output. But not only geopolitical disruptions as well. One could also witness weather-related outages. And at the same time, also looking forward to the end of the year, usually the third and the fourth quarters are quarters that oil demand are quite strong. So the Russian disruption, if it materializes, that big loss actually is going to have a big impact on the oil market dynamics.
Okay, I mean, presumably then prices spike higher. So how do you see the outlook for demand if there's a loss of Russian crude? I mean, if prices do spike significantly, are we going to see demand coming down equally significantly?
Well, the impact on demand will depend very much on the size of the disruption. before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we were expecting global oil demand growth of around 3.2 million barrels per day in 2022 and 2 million barrels per day in 2023. Now, in our reference, in our latest report, global oil demand growth was revised downward to 2.6 million barrels per day in 2022, while the forecast remains relatively unchanged at 1.5 million barrels per day in 2023. Under the curtailment case, where we lose 4 million barrels per day, of course, the impact is much larger. Demand growth falls to 2.2 million barrels per day in 2022, but the biggest impact will be felt in 2023, where the growth falls to 0.5 million barrels per day, at least according to our models. Really, this should not come as a surprise, because under the curtailment scenario, Brent reaches more than $155 per barrel, if I remember correctly, before it starts falling as supply and demand responses accelerate. You know, oil demand responses are quite big and perhaps larger than what others are projecting. Some are arguing that oil prices have to get to much higher level than current levels for demand reduction to happen at a large scale. However, the oil price shock is just one of the many shocks that are hitting consumers and industry. Consumers are also being hit by higher gas prices, higher electricity prices, and higher food prices on top of higher gasoline prices. And this is also impacting consumer sentiment and confidence. Industry is also hit by rising energy costs and supply chain bottlenecks. And in the background, there are serious inflationary pressures, and this may cause central banks to increase interest rates sooner than planned. But having said that, Jim, one needs to take into account that this is a shock to products such as diesel and not only crude. In short, you know, consumers and industry are being hit by multiple shocks, and that's why we think the impact on demand may be big. But there might be some pent-up demand as economies open up, particularly when it comes to jet fuel, as many people may want to make up for lost travel during the pandemic. Also, governments all over the world, including in Europe, have been taking measures to protect consumers from rising energy costs, which will limit the impact on demand. So these are, you know, counterbalancing factors, but we're not taking into account that if oil prices rise a lot, then that can push governments to take certain policies that reduce oil demand directly. At the moment, we don't see signs of this happening yet, but, you know, that could change quite soon.
Okay, well, look, you've mentioned products, and maybe we should go on to some more practical issues. And so refiners, I mean, how have they been impacted by their need to buy certain grades of crude? Has this been a major problem as Urals has kind of reduced in availability?
Well, yes, and it's quite important to put it in context, because even before the war, European refiners were facing a cost shock in terms of rising crude prices and increase in the cost of refining, specifically as gas and hydrogen prices have risen sharply. And this was already having implications on product supply, such as diesel and gasoline. Actually, distillate markets were particularly under severe pressure. In Europe, distillate stocks have been declining and distillate prices have been rising. Then comes the war, which makes the diesel market situation worse. It's important to remember that in addition to crude, Russia is also an important exporter of products, particularly diesel. And Europe is heavily reliant on Russian diesel. Also, Russia is an exporter of fuel oil and VGO, which are important feedstock for refineries both in Europe and the US. So the loss of Russian diesel contributed to further tightening of the market. So the question is really, how are the markets dealing with this diesel shock? In multiple ways, I would say, you know, high prices in Europe are opening the arbitrage, and diesel cargoes from Asia, particularly from India's refineries, are already heading to Europe and already filling the gap. It's quite important to remember that distillate markets in Asia are also tight due to increased demand and, you know, as economies open up, and that China's state-owned refineries also are projected to cut export, though COVID could alter this dynamic. I also hear that Russian diesel is still arriving in Europe through the process of blending. At one point, the market was pricing diesel cargoes from Russian and non-Russian origin differently, with non-Russian diesel being offered at a large premium. But these premiums have declined recently. Also, you know, the definition of non-Russian diesel is not clear and does not mean that a non-Russian diesel cargo will not contain Russian diesel. It may contain Russian diesel, but perhaps less than 50%, or perhaps it has been loaded from non-Russian ports. This more generally really shows the fungibility of oil products. Russian crude can go to Indian refineries, refined there, and sent back as products to Europe. Or Russian products could be blended with other non-Russian products. These have helped ease the diesel shortage so far. The question really is how long this could last. Would pressure from consumers and media, especially that it's easier now to monitor and track these flows, would eventually, you know, under this pressure, you know, those diesel flows will reduce. I think as the war escalates and becomes more protracted, the risks to these flows will increase, and they will come under much more scrutiny.
Okay, great. Well, look, we're sort of coming towards the end of our time, but let's quickly run through some of the alternative supplies that you see out there if Russian crude particularly is removed from the market. Why don't we start with Iran? What's the situation with Iran and potential increase in supply?
Well, it seems that Iran's nuclear negotiations have taken a setback. In our reference case, we still assume that Iran would ramp up its production in the second half of this year. But we may have to revise this and assume in our reference non-nuclear deal. Having said that, it's important to point to two things. Iran production and exports have been rising in recent months. So in a way, Iran has been returning to the market. Not fully, but certainly Iran's return to the market has started a few months ago. Also, this means that even if a nuclear deal is reached, the increase from Iran is likely to be limited to something around 1 million barrels per day from current levels. Iran will reach 3.8 million barrels per day, but this will take some time. I think the fact that the U.S. and its allies decided to release stocks from the SPR indicates that chances of reaching a nuclear deal quite soon has been reduced.
And what about OPEC more broadly? What's the upside potential there?
So far, there is no indication that OPEC Plus will change its course from the current deal of gradually increasing its supply. Also, one has to take into account that most countries within OPEC Plus have already reached their maximum capacity and in no position to increase output further. Actually, outside Saudi Arabia, UAE, and perhaps Iraq, the other countries really will not be able to increase output from the current levels. In the last phase of the deal between August 2021 and September 2022, OPEC Plus, and excluding Russia, was expecting to bring around 4.2 million barrels per day, but instead we estimate that it can only return around 3.3 million barrels per day. So basically, almost 1 million barrels per day below its target.
And is Russian influence on OPEC Plus having any kind of weight in those decisions? I mean, how do you see that Russian influence in OPEC Plus at the moment?
Well, it depends very much on the time horizon you take. In the short term, all indicators are that that Russia is keen to keep the relationship with OPEC. Also, from OPEC perspective, it took years to build this relationship, and OPEC would also like to maintain this relationship, I think. When the cycle turns and you need to balance the market on the downside, Russia could play an important role in this rebalancing. In the medium to longer term, however, I think Russia's position within OPEC Plus will weaken for the simple fact that due to sanctions, it will not be able to increase its productive capacity or may even witness a decline in this capacity. In contrast, other key producers within OPEC have solid plans to increase capacity. This will certainly alter the power dynamics within OPEC in favor of the Gulf producers.
Okay, well, we've talked about OPEC and Russia. What about non-OPEC supply? What about the US in particular? What's the short-term potential there?
In 2022, we are expecting the US to increase supply year on year by around 1 million barrels per day. And this is a large number. But again, it's important to put US shale in some context. US production has not yet recovered to the pre-COVID highs. A lot of the recent increase in output came from utilizing drilled but uncompleted wells, what is known as DUCs, and the stock of these DUCs has been exhausted and have reached very low levels. Also, U.S. shale is facing some inflationary pressures and bottlenecks. But the biggest change for the U.S. shale has really been the capital discipline that shale producers have been showing so far. And despite the increase in cash flows, these have not really been translated into similar increase in capex. And a big part of the cash flow is being returned to shareholders and paying off debt. And really, without an increase in capex, the growth in U.S. shale will be much more limited beyond 2022. I think more fundamentally, the idea that U.S. could act as a swing producer on the upside is behind us now. U.S. shale constitute a flexible source of supply, but certainly the lags are long for it to act as a swing producers. And I think those lags are becoming even longer as ESG restricts financing into this sector.
Okay, and also you've mentioned earlier the release of strategic reserves. What impact have they had?
Well, the release from the SPR is quite large, around 1.3 million barrels per day per month between May and September 2022, and will certainly help ease the pressure on balances. But the impact of SPR releases on crude prices are usually short-lived and depends very much on the size of the disruption. You know, even after the announcement of the SPR release, prices did ease. But concerns about bigger disruptions from Russia and somewhere else erased all these price losses. Also, we discussed, the issue is not only about crude, but also product prices such as gasoline and diesels. And we have done some modeling on the impact of the SPR release. And really, the impact is quite small. It's in the matter of between $5 to $8, depending basically very much on the scenario. So it help eases the balances, but I'm not sure whether it's going to have an enduring impact on prices, especially if the disruption turns out to be bigger than we are currently thinking.
Okay, well, let's conclude then on prices as you've mentioned them. What's your outlook for prices under your different scenarios? And interestingly, what would happen if the war ends soon, actually?
In this rapidly changing environment, it's really extremely difficult to predict the oil price. So I think the best one can do is to construct different potential scenarios. Bigger supply disruption from Russia, Iran nuclear deal not reached, demand responses to oil prices turn out to be stronger than currently expected. The U.S. releases more stocks from the SPR. Models about the U.S. shale response. So you can consider a lot of those types of scenarios. Now, in some of the extreme scenarios, the oil price could hit $160 per barrel. So, for instance, if Russian disruptions turn out to be quite large, if Iran nuclear deal is not reached, if non-OPEC response is limited, and OPEC Plus returns fewer barrels than currently anticipated. So this is one set of scenarios. Other scenarios, you could see multiple, sources of supply coming at the same time to the market and demand response being stronger. And, under this scenario, we could see the price fall to the 85 to 90 range by year end. So in our latest report, we construct something like 30 scenarios, and we find that the price range is quite wide. And that actually is quite expected because it reflects the high degree of uncertainty. So it can go basically any way from $96 per barrel, to be specific, to $142 per barrel in 2022 and $76 per barrel and 125 barrels in 2023, according to our models. But as I said, these are just scenarios and, they might be valid at this stage. And, one of the biggest uncertainties is that we really still don't understand how big the supplies disruption is likely to be. Even if the war stops tomorrow, I think the sanctions are likely to continue. And as a result of this, that wide uncertainty is likely to stay for us for the foreseeable future. So sorry, Jim, I cannot come with a specific price. I can come with some ranges, and I understand those are wide ranges, but those reflects the wide uncertainty that we are seeing.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Bassam. That was absolutely fascinating insight into the current state of oil markets and the risks of what might happen if Russian export flows are cut. For any of our listeners who want a bit more detail, I'd encourage you to go to our website and look for the latest Oil Monthly, which was out in the beginning of April. Right, now let's turn to gas markets. I'm turning to my colleagues again, Mike Fullwood and Jack Sharples, who've been with us for the last couple of podcasts. And we're going to just kind of review the current state of gas markets, what's been going on with flows, storage and prices. And Jack, let me come to you first. Give us our regular update on what's happening with flows of Russian gas. Are they continuing to hold up?
Well, certainly the flows to Northwest Europe now are almost exclusively, or they are exclusively, via the Nord Stream pipeline, which is operating at 100% of its capacity. However, the Yamal Europe pipeline, particularly measuring the flows from Poland into Germany, we're not seeing any onward flow of Russian gas there. So everything that's arriving into Northwest Europe is Nord Stream. The spare capacity on the Yamal Europe route suggests that Gazprom's European counterparties are not exactly maximising their nominations of contract gas. Where we have seen a significant change over the last 10 days or so is the drop-off in Russian gas transit via Ukraine. Now, the onward flows to Hungary, to Poland and Romania are unchanged. Where we've seen the knock-on effect is the flow into Slovakia, Austria and on to Italy. So again, this suggests that it's being driven by nominations by Gazprom's long-term contract counterparties, particularly in Italy.
Okay, so just to be clear, there's no physical issues inside Ukraine as far as we know?
No, not as far as we're aware, no.
Okay, so Mike, let me come to you then. I mean, if that's the situation with Russian gas flows, what about LNG, which has been sort of topping up Europe? Are we still seeing Europe attracting all the spare LNG in the global market?
I mean, yes, thanks, Jim. Pretty much. I think April remains very, very buoyant. It looks as though LNG to Europe has been very strong. It may well exceed the record, which was just in March. So, LNG is still flooding towards the European markets. And in the first 4 months, it looks as though LNG to Europe could be 20 BCM higher than last year. So an increase year on year of 30 BCM looks achievable because the summer was quite weak for Europe last year. But that will depend on demand elsewhere. Imports in the US are already 15 BCM higher than last year. And they probably were when Biden and von der Leyen stood up and announced that the US has sent 15 BCM more. Well, it kind of already happened. In terms of demand elsewhere, China still looks weak. There are reports that domestic gas production has been stepped up quite a lot. And obviously, we're looking at potentially weaker economic activity with the lockdown in Shanghai and elsewhere in China. So China imports could be a little bit not grow as strongly as we might have thought. South America's down a lot with it raining in Brazil and Chile. But I think the rest of Asia would expect to see some stock build into the regas terminals through the summer. So we'd still expect growth year on year in LNG demand outside Europe. If we just step back and look at the winter period, October 2021 to March 2022, LNG to Europe was up 25 billion cubic metres compared to the previous winter. And that just simply replaced the lower imports from Russia on Nord Stream 1, Yamal, Europe and Ukraine. So, it's basically the lower Russian imports were offset by higher LNG.
Okay, that's great. Look, Jack, let me come back to you then. Given those flows and essentially one-for-one replacement of Russian gas exports with LNG, what's the news on storage? The last couple of weeks you've been quite positive. What's the story now?
Yeah, I actually remain cautiously positive. Picking up on what Mike was saying about the one-for-one replacement of Russian gas, that suggests that a lot of this has been going into storage. And in fact, European storage stocks on the 17th of April were just over 30 BCM, which puts us exactly where we were 12 months ago. It's also exactly the same as where we were in the spring of 2017 on the same date as well. So we've given ourselves a good platform, at least, to begin our summer injections and to try and hit that target of 80% of European storage capacity to be full by the 1st of November. Now, of course, that can be achieved if we follow the same injection pattern as last summer. But obviously, the pricing environment is even more challenging than it was last summer. And we have this additional uncertainty of saying, well, you know, that storage target is achievable as long as the Russian gas continues to flow.
Okay. So, Mike, let me come back to you then and talk a little bit about prices then. I mean, perhaps you could run us through. I mean, given that we're relatively positive on storage, prices should be a little lower. Is that the case?
Well, yes. I mean, actually, they dropped quite sharply on the Thursday, April the 14th. TTF prices finished at their lowest level since before the invasion, so they came off quite a bit. And also, the daily day-ahead TTF price is significantly below the monthly index, which probably explains to some extent why nominations on the Ukraine route to Italy and other places have been down quite a bit, because it's cheaper to buy gas on the market than nominate under your monthly contract. And the other interesting thing is the NBP is now at a very big discount to TTF. We've seen flows continue to the continent down the interconnector and BBL to some extent. And it's, you know, gas cut, much more gas can't really get into those pipelines to flow out. So there's been almost a little bit of decoupling. NBP on the close on Thursday was its lowest level since mid-September. So it shows how much that price has sort of come off. Having said that, there's still a lot of nervousness in the market regarding the ruble payment issue and what might happen if buyers are seen as not complying, as seen by the Russians as not complying. So there's still a bit of nervousness about what Gazprom and Russia might do if somebody's accused of not complying with the ruble payment mechanism. So I guess watch this space. I think the invoices for March should be being paid, I think, this week if it's on a sort of normal sort of cycle. So we'll see what the payments come out there. Just the last thing on prices, actually, I've talked about Henry Hub for almost ages, have we? But they've risen rapidly in the last few days, to well over $7 on the back of very strong demand, obviously, from US LNG exports, but also very high coal prices, which are on an equivalent basis about $10 a million BTU. That's limiting the switch away from gas. So there's a big pull on Henry Hub prices, more LNG exported, as Biden said. Although if that's causing higher US prices, it maybe not bodes well for Biden in the midterm elections in November.
Okay, thanks. Can you say anything a little bit about winter-summer prices as well? Jack's mentioned the storage, but it might be worth just noting where we are on summer-winter.
Well, I think it's sort of, to call it a curve, it's a straight line, basically. It seems to be just pretty flat. There's very little summer-winter spread opening up. I think if storage is to fill to reach the target, then we do need Russia to flow gas probably round about the sort of take-or-pay levels, which is sort of the March flows and higher than the current flows. To the extent they do that, and to the extent that obviously LNG still is attracted towards the European markets, we then could see, I think, maybe summer prices come off a little bit as more supply comes on, which could actually create the margin to make storage look profitable in terms of injecting in summer and taking out in the winter. But I would emphasise this does require Russia to continue flowing gas at take-or-pay levels, at March levels, and for Europe not to try and reduce flows significantly, as the REPowerEU plan sort of suggested.
OK, well, look, thanks, Mike. Thanks, Jack, for those comments. Obviously, we'll see what happens with Russian flows going forward, and I'm sure we'll review those in coming weeks. Thanks also to Bassam for his contribution on oil markets, and thanks to you all for listening as well. And as I say, please do keep following our research on this Russia-Ukraine war impact on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. With that, thank you again and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.